Blog Talk Radio.
Yo, check this out. This is Fresh Get Out the China Man with the 2 Live Crew.
Yo, what's up, y'all? It's me, DMC.
What's up, y'all? This is the Blunt Master P.
Yo, check us out. Chuck the Public Enemy.
Yo, what's up? This is DJ Yella from the world's most dangerous group.
What's up? This is DLC.
This is your boy, C-Man.
This is Jerry Heller, motherfucker.
This is your boy, DJ Paul KOL 365.
Young Busy Bomb.
Vice One.
Yo, this is DJ Reddy Red.
What up? This is the real Rick Ross. You listen to me on the Murder Master Music Show.
This is the show that shows no limits, broadcast nothing but the real. Interviews with legendary artists, still got love for the underground feel. Rappers with records, reveal the addition of rappers that are coming up, get them put on. We need a platform to fight the mainstream. The show that you need to be on. Hit up UGS for life on the screen and follow up with it.com. For all of your needs, production and mixing and mastering, graphics, and download the time. Check out the archives and touch with the shows. Plenty of content for you to get through. Everything free to download and stream. Oh yeah, we deserve the real review.
Unstoppable, we beat, we fought our bitch, we represent. All them killers on the mic, and we should love to all your fans.
I'm a man-made guy, crazy knocking all you rappers off. It's underground society, it's beauty, it's a light dog. Hip-hop ain't dead, representing for the legend. Rapping mumble rappers, so me, sitting on the hip. Two pocket beats, dreaming, thank you for the bliss. It's a murder masking music show. Free the homie gangsta crow. I see these rappers on these streets, I got my job about to blow. Stay up on that raw shit, uncut street shit.
Keep it up forever, bitch, we coming hella strong. I see you feeding for the show.
Hey, what's up, everybody? This is Prez. It's your boy right here on the Murder Mash Music Show, episode 459. Tonight we have a very, very special guest. I'm talking about not just a gold-selling producer or multi-platinum-selling producer, but a diamond-selling producer. This guy has done stuff, of course, for 415, but also, you know, SIBO, Master P, the Loonies, most notably Tupac. I'm going to bring him on in a second. Let me bring on my co-hosts, Pittsburgh Pat and Mac J. How you guys doing tonight?
Yo, what up?
What's up with it, Pri? What's up with it, Pat?
What up, Mac?
You good with it, man?
Hell of a show. You know, we've had plenty of producers on here before. The likes of DJ Reddy Red, of course, Mr. Mix, KLC. I mean, you name it. And this is one of the guys I really, really wanted to have on the show. I'm so glad we were able to make it happen. Shout out to Edna. Let's bring on the one and only DJ Daryl, man. DJ Daryl, how you doing, brother?
Man, I'm good, man. Can y'all hear me clearly?
Oh, yeah,
we can hear you good.
Okay,
yeah,
cool.
Welcome
cool.
To the
I'm
show,
doing
man.
Good, man. I'm just moving slow. I'm getting
man,
comfortable.
Well, I tell you what, man, you know, I grew up off a lot of your music over the years, man. I mean, when you talk about Tupac, Master P, SIBO, every one of those guys has incredible catalogs of music, you know what I'm saying? You had production, you know, with all those guys and so many other people, man. Can you do me a favor and go back for our listeners and tell everybody where you started and got your introduction into the game, please?
Oh, man, my start comes from the streets, you know, it comes really from the hood because, you know, most of the guys growing up in my hood, you know, they was hustling, they was trying to make, you know, get money from, you know, hustling, and they got to a point where, you know, they had enough money to really do anything, and at that time, everybody was trying to take their money and invest it into some type of music or rapper or whatever, you know, to clean it up. So when you have Too Short, he had some Street Investor and MC Hammer and all those, and of course Richie Rich, we had our executive producer, and he had the idea to not just invest into just a rapper but also a DJ. I was a DJ at the time, and back then a DJ was your beat maker. So it started from that, you know. And our executive producer, he
early days,
this is
early
like
88. 90s, late 80s. What are you talking about? Like
88. We're talking about 88, 87, 88. You know, and
wow.
it kind of spoiled me a little bit because our executive producer, he was only like maybe 2 or 3 years older than me, but he had a certain type of style about himself, you know. So he feel like whatever we do, we're going to have to do it on a major level, you know. So he had us recording in a really nice studio at the time. You know, we was, you know, the studio we was recording at was considered to be like high end, which is how we met Digital Underground, which how we met Tupac. You know, they was all on a major label and we was independent, but we was working
right.
for street money, so we was operating like a major, you know. So it was a good thing to be able to work under those kind of in that kind of level, because that's how we right. met. So that's like the start right there. Yeah.
And did you and Tupac hit it off right away?
Well, not really. Well, it the way it went, it's funny because I didn't even know Tupac was a rapper. Me and Rich, I was always Rich's DJ, you know. So Rich, he wanted to start a group, and we did a audition for a third member of a group, the 415. 415 is Richie Rich's
right.
whole ideal. He wanted to have a group called 415. So while we recording, we will do what you call studio blockout times. So we have like 8 hours a day for like maybe 3 months, and Digital Underground had it the same way. So when we're coming out of the studio, they're coming in. So this one particular time, we're folding up our session, getting ready to wrap it up, and Digital Underground coming in. And you know, this we don't really know each other. We just kind of see one another in passing. You know, they listen to some of our music. We listen to some of their music as we passing. But this, and you know, it's not really a big deal because everybody's competitive. But this one guy was just like, "Man, who did that track? Man, who was this? What's the name of y'all group, man? Y'all?" You know, he was just real interested in our whole sound and what he was doing, and he was carrying equipment. Now, this is Tupac we talked about.
Mm-hmm.
And we didn't even know that he was a rapper. You know, we never heard a song on him or nothing. He just looked like one of the guys that was just carrying equipment. So he said, "Man, when I get my deal, man, I want you to produce my whole album." And I'm like, "Yeah, man, it's all good." You know, then a couple of months go by. We hear him on he came by playing his demo. He had a demo, which was Tupacalypse Now. And that's when we're like, okay, this dude kind of tight. Make a long story short, he didn't have no creative control over that project. So he's like, "Man, I'm gonna make sure you produce my next album." And this was the album Troublesome 21. And me and Tupac, we got in the car, went to a record store. We stayed in a record store for about 2 hours, just buying up all kind of records that he wanted to use for samples and whatnot. And he had just got some money from something. I don't know. I think it was a Juice movie. And he bought a bunch of equipment. So he wanted me to work on his equipment, you know. But I still have my drum machine. So we just did a lot of pre-production right in his living room.
And
he called me in
Troublesome 21. This was his first and second album. This was actually going to be his second album, right?
This was going to be his second album, yeah. And we went to L.A. and we recorded everything in L.A. We pre-produced everything in his living room, but we went to go record it in the studio in L.A. And
right.
I tell people ask me all the time, what was it like working with Tupac? And I can honestly tell you, it wasn't fun, you know. Working with Tupac wasn't really fun, you know. Because I'm coming from working with, you know, Richie Rich. Me and Rich got a real chemistry in the studio. You know, it's vibing going on. We bouncing off of one another. We throwing ideas off of one another. Tupac wants you to rush and do everything. Come on, man, we gotta get to the next song. You know, like I'm a perfectionist with my music, so I like to make sure everything is sounding good. Now, I never really told people this, but I mean, I told the story, but I never explained to people the reason. One of the reasons why I think Keep Your Head Up was so successful, because that's really the one song that we actually took time to really produce and put together. And the reason why, because we're in Studio B at the studio, and DJ Pooh and Yo-Yo is in Studio A. Now Tupac and Yo-Yo used to date one another, so of course they're going back and forth in each other's studio session to see who's doing what and how their sound, how their music coming out. And it just so happened, Yo-Yo working, DJ Pooh was working on a song for Yo-Yo called "This Beat Is So Funky," and I'm doing "Keep Your Head Up" at the same time. I don't know if you ever heard Yo-Yo's version of "This Beat Is So Funky," but it's the same sample as "Keep Your Head Up," the same Roger Troutman sample.
Right.
So, wow, that's crazy.
So Tupac goes there, come out, and he's like, "DJ, we gotta make this. We gotta make this." Well, he called me Daryl. He's like, "Daryl, we gotta make this a hit, man. They using the same beat." And I'm like, "What?" So DJ Pooh coming out session, he listening to my beat, and I go in this session and listen to the same sample. So it turned into a competitive competition type thing, you know, friendly competition.
Right,
thing.
Right then and there.
So now we trying to do everything we can to make this song outdo theirs, you know. And when we finished the song, you know, it still wasn't giving us that thing. So he got on the phone, called up his partner, the Black Angel, to sing the hook. And a lot of people don't know, but that was Dave Hollister at the time. So
yeah,
Dave on there singing. Yeah, he came on there and sang the hook, and once it was done, it was a wrap. You know, everybody was agreed that this song was, you know, DJ Pooh's song was nice, but ours kind of just, you know, stood out the most.
Still to this day too.
Still to this damn day. Big song.
I'll tell you what, man.
It's my first.
Tupac, still to this day, his music is timeless. You know what I'm saying? You produce some of that, man. Like, Keep Your Head Up's one of his biggest hits. You know, how does that make you feel knowing that you contributed to the legacy of this iconic, you know, figure that's going to be around for centuries?
Well, I'm gonna tell you, you know, a lot of people don't really know, but that was his first platinum record, and it was my first platinum record. And I kind of had a taste of people gravitating to my music before he did, because when we did 415, it was like the biggest thing in the streets of Oakland. You know, everybody was, every car that was riding up and down the street was playing 415. And then we had the Tone Sideshow. Right, we kind of changed the whole outlook of Oakland, because, see, what people don't know is that the Sideshow, that was one of the big hits off the album, but that song kind of sparked everybody to come and see what the Sideshow was about. And Tupac, he hadn't got that taste yet. He hadn't got a taste of what it feel like to have everybody playing your song. So when Keep Your Head Up hit, and it took the Strictly For My Niggas album to a platinum status, because I Get Around was doing this thing. I mean, Holla If You Hit Me was the first single, then I Get Around came, and it's the record still hadn't hit platinum yet. But when they released Keep Your Head Up, the video as a single, then the record hit that platinum status, and it was like, it was clear. Everybody was like, "This is the record right here. You know, this is the one that's gonna carry." So, I still didn't feel the impact of what it is today or where it was going. I still didn't feel it. It was because it was normal to me to hear everybody playing. I mean, it got to a point where they start playing it on the radio like 5 or 6 times a day for a whole year.
Right.
And I was like, okay, wait a minute. Every time but it was like that for me. With the 415, like I said, every car that was coming up and down the street, they was playing one of them songs off our album. But now I'm starting to get Keep Your Head Up on the radio. On the radio, 415 wasn't on the radio, but Keep Your Head Up on the radio. So it was feeling a little different, but it still hadn't hit me until like maybe a year passed, And I remember sitting, I think, in Warner Brothers' office, and I picked up this magazine. It was a Billboard magazine, and it was just showing how Keep Your Head Up was pretty much running the charts for a long period of time. And even to this day, it still hits charts. So I'm like, okay, this record is doing some big things, but I hadn't made no money off of it yet.
Yeah.
So a year went by before I ever seen any money off of it, other than, you know, the initial production fee they paid me. I hadn't started seeing no royalties until I had to get my attorney involved, and it just so happened that I actually got a really good deal throughout that whole process of the royalty split because of the sample. Roger Troutman, he called the shots on who gets what. So he made it fair, you know. We all split it three ways, and I get what you call a artist royalty, which is unheard of. So it's that song it's been feeding me and my family since '93.
Wow.
Wow.
And that's what you want to see, DJ Dirla. You want to see producers getting their credit, because cats like Mr. Mix, who created whole sounds and genres, you know what I'm saying, were completely left out of the mix, so to speak. And it's good to see that, man. I'm glad that it's like that with you, man. Real talk.
Well, I tell you what it is, you know, because even with the 415 record, you know, it's a lot of. Back then, it wasn't a big deal if you sampled. We didn't call it sampling. We called it, you know, you just scratching a record and with a break, like a break beat. But the original writers of those records realized, hey, these little young kids making this rap music using our music and looping it, we can make money off of it.
Exactly.
So what happened is
in the process,
right? Well, so what happened is a lot of producers and DJs of that era, you know, they'd use a lot of sample music. They wasn't getting nothing. The writers of the original music was taking 100% of the publishing. So
that's how a lot of
people got cut out. A lot of producers and DJs got cut out of the loop. I'm grateful that. You know, Roger Troutman, he just happened to hear, you know, we had to let him hear the record to get the sample cleared. And he heard it and he was like, wow, this is great. You know, I love it, the way what you guys did with it.
Yeah.
He loved it. So he made sure we all was taken care of with the, you know, he shared everything with the, because he could have took 100% of the whole song, but he shared it. Now I'm forever grateful for that.
Oh, man, rest in peace to Roger Troutman, man. He was a great tour.
Sir. Yes, sir. Yes, he was.
Marvel, Tupac's gone, man. I believe he'd still be making dope records with cats like yourself today. You know.
Oh yeah, yeah. You know the thing is, I work with a lot of artists from out the Bay Area, and I think a lot of them think that they're going to gain some of the same kind of success that Tupac did, but they don't understand. You have to have a lot of things in order, you know. Tupac, for one, he understood. He was totally different from a lot of people in the way they think. You know, people today, they making music, they were always looking to try to make a song that's going to satisfy the clubs. Tupac never thought of, he even care about satisfying the clubs. He just wanted to get a message out to people like, this is what's going on in the world. This is the kind of music that inspires and moves people. I mean, when you release singles like Brenda's Got a Baby, Keep Your Head Up, I Ain't Mad at You, Dear Mama, those songs, those are not club songs. They're just feel-good songs, you know what I'm saying? And that's one of the main ingredients in the chemistry that Tupac had that a lot of artists still haven't tapped into. You know, and that's what's missing in today's music. Everybody's trying to satisfy the clubs. But nobody's thinking about what about 10, 15 years from now, how is that record going to play a part in anybody's lives? And that's one of the things I'm real grateful with with working with him, and I try to push that on other artists, but they don't get it. You know, they don't get it until they get older, you know, 10 years and went by, and they're like, man, I should have made a record like that, you know, especially out the Bay Area, because everybody, you know, they want to make all this mob street music, which is how I got labeled as the original mob creator, you know. And I never set out to create the mob sound. It just kind of so happened to come out like that. And what people don't know is, like, songs like okay, Keep Your Head Up. Keep Your Head Up wasn't the first feel-good record that I made. You know, the first, I'll give you an example. Like, the first record I produced for Richie Rich is Don't Do It. It's the same type of song as Keep Your Head Up. And then I did a song for Master P, If I Could Change. It's the same kind of song as Keep Your Head Up. Yeah. It's one of those songs that it's talking
it
about.
You thinking.
It makes you think about life itself.
Yeah.
Right. And those are the songs that kind of put those artists in different positions and made, you know, the consumers look at them different. And
those
are kind of
mob
about,
from out there too, right? From Oakland.
That's my
Steady
group.
Mob.
Yeah. Steady Mob was my group that I produced the whole Steady Mobbing project and took this to Master P. Now, If I Could Change was originally their song. And Master P, you know, he had a marketing strategy that, you know, that made sense. He was like, well, let me get on the remix of that song, but we'll call my version the original and call theirs the remix because they've never been heard of before. Nobody never heard of. And it made sense.
Helped them sell their album too, huh?
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, their album ended up doing $500,000 in 2 weeks, actually.
Yeah, he was on this shit, man.
Yeah, he was, man. He was a real sharp businessman. And see, a lot of people don't realize I was part of Beats by the Pound. I heard you mention KLC. I was a part of the whole little Beats by the Pound. And when I got over there, I was really impressed with all of them, man. They all the Beats by the Pound producers had great production, you know. And it made me wonder, well, what do they need me for, you know? But I understood, you know. I came over there and I had a different sound because they was all down south, and I came with a West Coast vibe, and it made sense because when I got there, he had brought Mystical over and he brought Snoop over, and I ended up doing Mystical's title track for Unpredictable. And
that was a cold
Snoop, you know.
You did a gang of cold shit, man. Look at your track record, man, you got a gang of the hits that people be still pumping to this day, you know what I'm saying? A lot of them you help craft and create, you know what I'm saying? So I'm always salute that,
man,
shit.
I appreciate you, man. I do. I you know, my wife, it'd be tripping her out how people take to my music like later on. And, you know, part of the reason is it's the way I think. In my mind, I say, well, I try to predict a sound that will be popular from 4 or 5 years from now, and I try to move to try to create something on that level. And just like today, I sold some music to some guys today, and they just was head over heels for it. I was like, they were just loving it. And I'm sitting back to myself like, wow, I've been sitting on this music for like maybe 5 years. And I played it for people, and they're like, okay, let me hear the next one. And it just take people some time to catch up to where my mind be thinking when I'm making music. Like, music I'm making today, it's going over people's head. But they probably get it in 2020. It's always been like that for me. I don't know what it is. I just always been ahead of myself.
Ahead of your time,
music,
man. You're ahead of your time.
Yeah. And,
I want to go back real quick there. I just want to ask you something. What happened to that Troublesome 21, man? Was that different from the Strictly project? I know you had some songs that you know, like Keep Your Head Up on there and whatnot, but were there some other songs that were scrapped for some reason? Or?
No, what happened was, you know, Ice-T did he came out with the group, Body Count, his group, and they did a song, the Cop Killer song. Mm-hmm. And when that song came out, it really messed with the whole industry. It really affected Time Warner stock. You know, people was protesting and people was pulling out of whatever Time Warner had going on. It was just it was messing with their stock to the point where Time Warner was like, well, maybe we should shut down our whole music department and just focus on movies because this is really affecting them. That one song that Ice-T did really affect the music industry heavily, you know. So, and this was right around the time we was finishing up Troublesome 21. So they, thank God, they decided not to close down the music department. But what they did decide was, okay, from now on, we're gonna make sure that we make music or release music from off our labels, our record labels, that are not so anti-police. So a lot of the music Tupac had on Troublesome 21, it was more, you know, he was more, you know, he had already had a lot of bad publicity with a trooper being shot from Tupacalypse Now. So yeah. they really had him under the microscope to make sure that he didn't have no music that was going to do any more damage than what Ice-T's song had did. So the records that we had, the record that we had, the Troublesome 21, had a lot of that on there. So what they did was they said, well, go back to the studio, take some of the lighter songs off of the Troublesome 21 album and put that towards a new album that's not so anti-police. So those songs that we originally did for Troublesome 21, they just sat. Until he died. When he died, that's when everybody was just kind of scrambling for Tupac records. So a lot of those songs, are like seven of them, are on the Tupac album, the double album, Are You Still Down? Remember Me, Are You Still Down album. So I got seven of them that's on there. And then, you know.
Do you have any that you never released or that were never put out at all?
Well, it's crazy, and I'm glad you asked that, because when Tupac got out of prison, right, of course, me and Richie Rich, we was one of the first people to greet him when he came home from prison. So we went to L.A. and hung out with him. And I don't know if you ever remember when he was on Venice Beach doing an interview with the lady from MTV, where he was just walking on the beach with the lady. Well, me and Rich and a couple of our partners was with us. And once he finished up that interview, we all went to Death Row Studios, Can-Am Studios, and Tupac he played me a bunch of music. He had a DAC full of music, and he was like, DJ, I want you to hear these songs and tell me what you think, you know. And they was all nice, and I'm like, which one you gonna use? He's like, I'm using all of them. I say all of them. I mean, it was a bunch of beats. And that's when I found out he was doing a double album. Now, mind you, he'd already played me some stuff that Dad did for him. And that was, you know, Ambitious of a Rider and songs like that. So I wasn't even tripping on doing a record for him because there was so many producers. I mean, when we was at the studio, you had a room full of producers and a room full of singers and two other magazines in there waiting to interview him. So I wasn't really tripping on doing a song for him. You know, because I know he had his hands at any producer, you know, Dre or whoever. But he said, DJ, I need you to make me a beat. And I'm the only one in there making beats right on the spot. You know, Johnny J was in there and Doug Rashid. So I made a song for him right there on the spot. And it was called Call. You Can Call. You Can Call. That's what it's called. And I never got to finish the song. I did it. And we put a little rough mix on it, and he told me, you know, this right here going to be a single, but it's not going to be a single for All Eyes on Me. It's going to be a single towards another record, another album. And I said, cool. You know, it was nice. It had a nice song, a nice hook on there. It was like another hit. But years go by, and I just happened to be surfing YouTube, and I hear the song, I hear the lyrics, and it says, You Can Call, and it has a remix with Jazzy Faye on it. And I'm like, whoa, wait a minute, how this happened? So I let my wife know, this is my song. So we do a little research. We find out that they didn't give the production credit to Johnny J. So So they think Johnny J did the song, and he gave permission to remix the song. But the original had never been released. So that's one of the songs that never been released. And there's another song that's leaked on YouTube called Still Don't Give a F. That's never been released. That's been leaked. So it's a couple of them. And it's like seven more that has not been released yet.
So there's still Tupac music out there that many of us haven't heard.
Yeah, there is.
That's dope to hear, man. That's dope. Wow. I found out about Eazy-E having unreleased tracks that go back as far as 87. We actually got to hear one of them here on the show one time from Crazy Z, who was down with NWA. But, man, I'll tell you what, we're going to go break. But before I do, one last question on Tupac. You know, we've had so many authors on here, directors, people from Death Row, people at New Pop and everything. We always ask them, you know, what is your thoughts on what do you think happened to Pac? Do you think it was a John Lennon thing where the government silenced him? Do you think it was some Blood and Crip stuff? What are your thoughts on that, DJ Dale?
Well, you know, I'm going to tell you this. You know, Tupac, he's already under a microscope, you know, even when he was in Oakland. For whatever reason, he got beat up by the Oakland police. That was the first thing that really was big that happened to him. And when you look at his background and recognize who Pac really was, you know, because people got him kind of twisted. You know, he wasn't, you know, people look at Tupac in the Death Row days and they just draw the conclusion about who he was. But that wasn't who he really was. Tupac was really an artist. Like, I mean, the man did poetry. The man was an actor. You know, the man read a lot of books and knew a lot about history and knew a lot about his culture and his people. So he was really about that. But there was times like, I remember one time we went to the store, and of course, he had just finished doing Juice. So of course people were like, oh, it's Tupac, you know, it's Bishop, you know. And then you got a couple of dudes that's looking at him like, yeah, you was hard in that movie, but are you hard in real life, you know? And it's like it shocked him. He was like, I mean, this is how people really viewing me? People really believe what they saw in the movies or what they heard about him and not really knowing him. So that kind of put him in a certain corner. Like, he got to come out swinging. He got to come out being the rah-rah, I'm a hardcore, I'm going to get you before you get me, Tupac. But he really wasn't about that, you know. So I think a lot of things were going on in his life, a lot of things he was finding out when he was over at Death Row, you know, because there's a lot of things people don't know that's internal. Like, people think Suge bailed him out. Suge really didn't bail him out, you know. But he learning things, and you find out, it's like finding out for the first time that Santa Claus is not real. It does something to you. So he's learning a lot of things about people. He learned some stuff about Dr. Dre. He learned some stuff about Suge. He learned a lot of stuff that got him caught up. And he's in the middle of some things that he really, really didn't have no business being a part of. I mean, even with the situation with New York, me and Rich, we try to tell him, man, you got to be careful with them cats out there, you know, because they looking at you like you switched sides because you're originally from New York and now you are in the West Coast, claiming West Coast. You know, you got to be careful with hanging out with them cats out there. And the next thing you know, he gets the situation over at Quad Studio. So I think Pac just believed that everybody that had the same skin color as him had love for him. And he was finding out the hard way that wasn't necessarily true. And he just continued to go on and on until he got killed. So to say it was a government conspiracy, I won't say that, you know. I don't know if you have seen the documentary on him and Biggie where they solved the case?
Oh, with Keith D, murder rap? Yeah. Yeah, murder rap.
Yeah,
we had we actually had Kading and Mike Dorsey on the show before. We've had so many different people. I mean, there's other people that wrote books and stuff, and you know, I'm convinced that what they said is true. I mean, what do you feel about that?
Well, it is. I mean, I was told the story. You know, I was told that that's what happened years ago. I mean, even when we went to go meet up with Tupac, I mean, he told us a lot of things about Puffy and all of those guys, you know. And to be honest with you, a lot of it, like I said, a lot of the drama he was caught up in, it wasn't even really his drama. You know, it was more bigger than him. And I just think because he was the one that was with the biggest mouth, you know, he was the voice for all of it. He the one that got hit.
So
you know?
He had concerns.
And that's the only
one. He had, not to cut you off, Daryl, but you're saying he had some, he brought up some concerns about people like Puffy. Was he afraid that Puffy was trying to have him killed?
No, he wasn't afraid. He wasn't really afraid of anything. He never displayed no fear to me. It was just things that he was finding out for the first time. You know, he was finding out some stuff. You know, like, you know, people didn't, because he told us, you know, I'm making a record talking about Puffy and Biggie and all them. So he knew that all the stuff that happened to him in the Quad Studio, he knew that it was more people involved than what the world knew. Like, he knew Puffy was involved, but he couldn't prove it. You know what I'm saying? He couldn't prove it. So people thought he was making up a West Coast, East Coast beef, but really they conspired against him. You know, they was conspired against him. The people that did what they did to Tupac, they was working for Puffy as bodyguards. They was Puffy's bodyguards. So he felt like if they didn't set it up, they knew what was going to happen. I mean, it's just like, come on, man. You know what's going on. It was just weird. It was a lot of weird stuff, and it just didn't make sense to him. So in his mind, they all had a part. They all played a part. So, I mean, like I said, he was learning a lot of different stuff, you know, learning a lot of different stuff about the music industry, you know, because one of the things he told us that he was dating Madonna. And he said he learned a lot of stuff about Madonna. You know, and a lot of stuff about the industry that he learned from Madonna. So it's a lot of things that was internally going on around Tupac that was just kind of shocking him. You know, he told us a story about what's his name, Quincy Jones, and it was a shocking story. But once again, he was learning things about how Hollywood operate, and you know,
he was dating Quincy Jones's daughter, but he said something shocking about Quincy Jones, and you said that he was talking about how he was learning how the industry was operating. Are you kind of referring to what we're seeing today? Like, was Tupac discovering, like, hey man, there's some weird cult like shit going on here?
It's a real homosexual cult-like things going on that Tupac wasn't with, you know, and people was approaching him with some of this stuff, like offering him certain positions if he was a part of certain things that was going on in Hollywood. He, you know, Tupac was he was too real to play a part in any of those things. So when he started finding out that a lot of people that he kind of lightweight looked up to, and that they already played certain positions to get what they got that he was offered, he kind of lost a lot of respect for a lot of people, and it just kind of made him rebellious. Like, I can't believe if this is what's going on. You know, it was a shock to him. There's a lot of things going on in Hollywood, because you got to understand, Tupac, he wasn't part of just the music part of the industry. He's part of the music and the acting. So he's catching it. He's seeing a lot of weird stuff. He's seeing a lot of weird stuff going on. And he believed that being a part of a label like Death Row, that stuff wouldn't touch them. That stuff wouldn't come across to him. But he found out.
That set in
he found out being over there that they right in the middle of some of that weird stuff. So you know, I know you heard the rumors where he said, you know, people say that he wanted to go off and start his own label, and he was going to, that was part of the plan, he was going to lead Death Row. Well, it was, you know. The last conversation that that me and Rich had with Tupac, he was telling us that he was going to make more music that was more spiritual. Songs like Hail Mary. He said he was going to do more songs like that, where he was going to start exposing people and talking about things that are taking place more on the spiritual side, because he was smiling out
and
stuff.
Basically distance. I mean, he was actually trying to distance himself from that, pretty much the Illuminati in Hollywood, which a lot of people are talking about right now. You know what I'm saying? Do you think that might have spawned Illuminati and his interest in all that?
Oh yeah, it did. It did. Huh. That's exactly what he was referring to. You know, that's what I'm saying. He was learning different things. You gotta understand, Tupac, coming from making the kind of records he was making to going to where the last stuff you hear him talking about on the Machiavelli album, you know, even the whole Machiavelli thing, all of that was a way for him to start exposing and telling the truth about what was going on in Hollywood and art, different artists that people were looking up to. You know, he was getting ready to open up a few doors and expose a few people.
Wow.
Yeah,
because
definitely.
he was taken off guard with some of the stuff that he was being approached with.
I tell you what, man, shout out to him for doing what he did and going to those lengths to expose what's going on. I remember you can hear it in what's that song where he went at Dre, Toss It Up. You know what I'm saying? He found some stuff out about Dre. And it coincides with his music, what you're saying, Daryl. Everything coincides. So, I mean, it's wild, man. And it's going on right now in Hollywood. It's going on right
now.
Yeah,
it's different pages of it are flipping over and over more and more as time goes on. You see more things being exposed, more people being exposed, more things being talked about, more things being shown. I mean, you think about it. Today, if Tupac was alive and you got cats running around here wearing blouses and dresses and, you know,
you wouldn't be having that shit, would
you?
Yeah,
they on some real nasty shit.
I can only imagine the kind of stuff Pac would be saying. He would be disgusted, and you know, he's the kind of person that talks loud and is passionate about how he really feels. He would be going in on people right now.
Yeah,
he really would.
I can imagine, especially now. It's crazy. And a lot of people, you know what I'm saying, they dropped the ball, even people that, you know what I'm saying, that he knew, you know, stay silent about this stuff. You know, and I think these guys are desecrating hip-hop. I mean, they're disrespecting the legends and pioneers. They're shitting on the legacy and the foundation that all y'all built, you know what I'm saying, over the decades. And I think, he wouldn't be having it, definitely. But let's go take a break real quick. Let's come back and chop it up about some other stuff, man. It's a hell of an interview, man. We got DJ Daryl right here on the Murder Master Music Show. Don't go nowhere. We'll be right back.
Something to my godson Elijah and a little girl named Corinne. Say the black of the best, the sweet of the juice. I say the dark of the flesh and the deep of the roots. I give a holler to my sisters on welfare. Tupac can. If don't nobody else care. And I know they like to beat you down a lot. And when you come around the block, brothers clown a lot. But please don't cry, dry your eyes, never let up. Forgive, but don't forget, girl, keep your head up. And when he tells you you ain't nothing, don't believe him. And if you can't learn to love you, you should leave him. Cause sister, you don't need him. And I ain't trying to catch up, I just call him how I see. You know what makes me unhappy? When brothers make babies and leave a young mother to be unhappy. And since we all came from a woman, got our name from a woman, and I came from a woman. I wonder why we take from our women, why we rape our women, do we hate our women? I think it's time to kill for our women, time to heal our women, be real to our women. And if we don't, we'll have a race of babies that will hate the ladies that make the babies. And since a man can't make one, he has no right to tell a woman when and where to create one. So will the real men get up? I know.
My buddy lost his whole family. It's gonna take the man in me to conquer this insanity. It seems the rain will never let up. I try to keep my head up and still keep from getting wetter. You know it's funny when it rains, it pours. They got money for wars but can't feed the poor. Said it ain't no hope for the youth, and the truth is it ain't no hope for the future. And then they wonder why we crazy. I blame my mother for turning my brother into a black baby. We ain't meant to survive cause it's a setup. And even though you're better, you gotta be on the head. Babies on their own. I know it's kind of rough and you're feeling all alone. Daddy's long gone and he left you by your lonesome. Thanks the Lord for my kids, even if nobody else want them. Cause I think we can make it, in fact, I'm sure. And if you fall, stand tall or come back for more. Cause ain't nothing worse than when your son wants to know why daddy don't love him no more. You can't complain, you were selfish. Hell of a hand without a man feeling helpless. If it did, you couldn't take it. And don't blame me, I was given this world, I didn't make it. And now my son's getting older and older and cold from having the world on his shoulders. While the rich kids are driving Benz, I'm still trying to hold on to surviving friends. And it's crazy, it seems they'll never let up. But, please, you gotta keep your head up.
Man, that never gets old. Never gets old. I tell you what, DJ Darryl, that's timeless, timeless track right there. Keep your head up.
Yeah, thank you, man.
Appreciate it.
DJ Darryl, legendary producer for so many different people. I'm going to let the fellas come in and take over now because I done said too much, man. But let's go into the No Limit era for a little bit if you don't care. And go ahead, and tell
that. Yeah, that's cool.
Yeah, man, I have to ask you this just on a personal note because, dude's one of my favorite artists ever, man. But you produced Street Life for Soulja Slim. Can you just reflect on working with Soulja Slim, what kind of dude he was, man?
It's funny you say that. You know, he told me about Soulja Slim before he actually introduced me to him. He's letting me know, man, this dude here is like a real street cat. This dude is like most feared cat in the hood. You know, he's letting me know that this dude was a real serious street cat, you know. And I'm like, okay, I don't know. I'm from California. I don't really know. So,
right.
The way. When he brought him over, you know, it was shocking to me. Every guy to understand everything that was happening at No Limit, for one, was like a big shock to me because I met Master P through a mutual friend of ours, you know, Freddie T. Smith, which was Sebo's executive producer. So, and when I met Master P, he just wasn't on a level like what people see him as now. You know, he was almost looked at as a joke in the Bay Area, like this country bumpkin dude trying to do a label thing. And I just never was one of them people that discriminated against what nobody was doing. You know, he came to me, he needed some production, and okay, I'm on my way. So anyway, when he introduces me to these people, I'm still in shock that how many records and how much money this company is making. You know, I mean, he put a lot of money in my pocket when I came over there, and then it continued to just keep going and keep going. So, you know, when you go to the No Limit offices, just the parking lot is full of Benzes and Vipers and all kind of cars.
Fucks out the having thing.
I'm like, man, this is really how he's doing it. So then he tells me one day, you know, I got Mystical coming over here. He about to sign. I'm like, wow, Mystical, okay. Then he tells me another day, I got Snoop coming over. Snoop? Wow, okay. Then he tell me about this dude, Soldier Slim. But he more impressed about Soldier Slim coming to the label more than Snoop and Mystical. And I didn't know why, because I never heard of him. I didn't know who he was. Hello? Julie?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we still here. Yeah, I'm
okay.
Still here.
Okay. So I just put a track together, you know, and I'm back and forth from Baton Rouge to California. So the time I'm in Baton Rouge, I put a few tracks together, and then I get back on the plane and I go. And KLC them kind of do all the engineering and, you know, producing the artist, engineering basically, you know. So I come mm-hmm. when I come back, they let me hear the whole record, and they're like, "It's your track right here," and I'm like, "Okay, I hear him. He's spitting."
Right.
And think too much of it, you know, because the whole process of making music at No Limit was way different from what I was used to. You know, I'm used to spending time in the studio on one song. We would stay in the studio and work on those songs until they was perfected to the best of our ability. You know, we had to make sure that everything on that song was perfect. Now, with No Limit, he works with Tupac. They work with Tupac at No Limit. They like, come on, let's go to the next song. You know, P would even pick up a pencil or a paper. He just, you know, the beat come on, he go in the booth and say his thing, and come on, KL, pull up that other song. And I'm like, whoa, wait.
Right, we had Mr. Servo on the show before, and he was saying the same thing. It was like a factory over there. He's like,
yeah,
you had these
dudes
in that room,
songs.
These dudes in that room.
Yeah, so I wasn't used to that. That was something way out of my league. So like I said, I made the beat, and I go either go to my room or I go get on the plane and be, you know, go, you know, back to California. So I didn't actually stay in the studio at the time when Slim did his part. So how it came out is how it came out. But it ended up being one of the favorites on his album. So I was like a little shocked about that.
Yeah, you made some classics over there, man. Shit, you had Time for 187, Silk's Murder. I still listen to that song all the time. That beat, just the beat, the way it come on, it sound like the damn electricity shocking you and shit. And then the way the beat kick, that's still a hard ass beat. And that motherfucker pounds, man. It pounds in the system still to this day.
I got to give you the story on that, right? So, like I said, Master P got most of his game from the Bay Area, so. And it's T from AWOL Records, the SIBO's executive producer. Mm-hmm. And he say, D, I need you to come down here to the studio and bring some beats. I'm down here with Master P, him and both to do a song together. So I had just did these four tracks. You know, this day I had four beats that I had just did today, and I burnt them on a CD. I said, okay, well, I'm gonna come down there, I'm gonna bring these four beats. And this is my first time meeting Master P. You know, I always heard about him. You know, we go to like the one stop shops and the distributors, and you know, mm-hmm. you see all this No Limit stuff all over the place, but I never met the man personally. So, anyway, I meet him for the first time. He's hella tall, you know, I'm only 5'6" and a half. And he hella tall, you know, and everybody that was with him hella tall. So I played the first beat, and he was like, I like that one. He was like, let me hear the next one. So he skipped to the next one. I like that one too. Let me hear the next one. He skipped to the next one. So he ended up liking all four of them. And at that time, I was charging like $2,500 a beat. And he liked all four of them. And I'm like, okay. This might be a nice little payday today, but he was like,
right.
"But I only brought enough money for." But he was like, "Only brought enough money for one of them, though." So I'm like, "Okay." So make a long story short, I ended up giving them all four. I said, "Well, just take all four of them, man. You know, whenever you get yourself situated, just hit me whenever, you know." Anyway, those four beats, the ones that you just named, those were those beats.
Mm-hmm.
Silk the Shocker, Time for 187, all those was those beats. And those are the beats that I gave him before I actually came over to No Limit. Now, I got to tell you this story because this is how when you do stuff like that, how it come back and, you know, people remember what you did for them. So I'm in L.A. Me and my partner, we're in L.A. I had the whole Steady Mobbin album, and I'm trying to get them a production deal. I'm trying to get a production deal using their album. And I'm talking to the guy over at Priority Records. His name was Dave Weiner. And I didn't even play the record. He was like, D, I already know you got some hot music, but I'm just going to tell you my hands are tired. I can't do nothing. So at this point, I'm ready to get up and leave. But he was like, hold on before you leave. I'm going to sit down. I want to tell you something about Master P. Now, I'm thinking, Master P, it's the guy that I just, you're talking about the same Master P? He's like, yeah. So he's going on and telling me how Master P is now over at Priority Records, and his company is growing. It's going to be bigger than Death Row. And I'm like, are we talking about the same Master P? You know, I'm shocked because he's telling me how this dude is getting ready to blow up and be the biggest thing in music. And I'm sitting there at the thing, and me and my partner looking at one another. I'm like, you sure we're talking about the same guy? He's like, yeah. He said, he knows you here. He's here in the building. I'm like, okay. So we go next door to an office. That's Master P's office. And sure enough, it was him. Uh-huh. And the man, he came right out. He said, I want to just be straight up with you. I want you to sign with the Beats. I want to sign you to my production team, Beats by the Pound. Uh-huh. And he just hit me just like that. And I was like, well, man, that's lovely. But my initial goal was to try to get this record. I'm trying to get a production deal for my group, Steady Mobbin. He said, well, I'm also doing a movie. Now, this is unheard of. You know, I'm just my hair just get blown back every few minutes. I'm like, wait a minute, this is the same Master P now. He's over here running Priority Records. And he offered me deals for production deals, and now he got a movie.
And he talking about a movie, right?
Yeah, now he's talking about a movie. I'm like, this is unheard of. Ain't no rappers been doing no movies other than Ice Cube. So anyway, he said, I need a single for the soundtrack. He said, let me hear some. If I hear something I like, we'll make it the single. So I put the dad in. The first song I played was If I Could Change, and it must have blew everybody's hair back because everybody from all the offices was coming to his office to hear that song. And when the office cleared, he offered me a ridiculous amount of money to sign with Beats by the Pound. And he offered to say, what we negotiated was the Steady Mobbin album. So part of the deal was to be able to channel the album through No Limit / Priority Records. And the rest is history. And right. I left the shit too
when it came out. Everybody in the hood was on that shit.
Yeah,
you're part of that, man. You're part of that 75 million record. I mean, that's just, it's amazing how you yourself, Daryl, went from, you know what I'm saying, all these, you know, 415, legendary group out of Oakland, to Tupac, to Master P, Looney's, all these guys, man, it's just amazing. The homie Sin from France, he has a question for you. I'm going to bring him out real quick. Sin, you got a question for Daryl?
Yeah. Hi, Scott, Button, Mark. Hi, DJ Daryl.
Yes.
I have to congratulate you because you have amazing productions. I studied your style since 20 years, and the work you did with C-Bo, it's crazy. From Tales from the Crypt, the song like Murder That You Read, Hurrah, I Know Sunshine, for Bomb Shelter's production, your production, and also That's How We Break Bread with Master P and C-Bo. Can you tell us about the work you did with C-Bo, Tales from the Crypt?
Okay, that's a good one, too. Let me tell you how that happened.
All that nuts.
My mom at the time, she lived in the projects in West Oakland. And I didn't live with my mom, but my studio, my pre-production studio was at my mom's house in my old bedroom. So what I would do, I would come from my house down to the hood where my mom still lived, and I would do production there. So I think I went to the park or something, played some basketball, and I was on my way back from the park, headed to my mom's house, and this gold Cutlass pulls up on me, gold Cutlass with some gold ones on it. And I'm looking like, who is this pulling up on me? Because I don't know these dudes. And it's the one dude on the passenger side, like, DJ Joe, what's up? It's such and such from. And I'm like, okay, I recognize him. He's like, man, I want to introduce to my partner T. So T stick his head out and say, he stick his head down and say, you DJ Duro? I say, yeah. The same DJ Duro that did Keep Your Head Up? I say, yeah. What you doing walking? You don't got a car? So he was looking like, why are you walking? You don't have no car or nothing? I'm like, no, I'm just coming from the park or whatnot. He said, well, man, I got a label, man. I need some beats for my artist. I said, okay, have my boy bring you by the house, man. I'll play a few beats for you. So he had already finished up the Autopsy record. That record was already done. So he said he really needed some music for Sebo's next album and Marvelous first album. So when he came in the house, I just went through a bunch of beats and he's standing in my old bedroom listening to the beats, and he just, you know, he ain't moved his head, he ain't bobbed his head, he ain't said nothing. He just listened to him, and I done went through like maybe five or six beats, and I had some big speakers, so I'm turning them up loud, making sure that he really feel them, and he just had a blank look to him, like he wasn't feeling none of them. So after I played the last beat, I say, anyone of them you like, are you here that you can think your boy can get down on? He said, man, I want all of them. I want all of them. I say, okay, I've been charged. He said, I already know how much you charge. I was getting ready to tell him how much I charge. And see, the reason why my price tag was so high, because I was in high demand. A lot of people was trying to get beats from me, and I couldn't provide them quick enough, so I had to put a price tag on them to slow people down. But T came, and he was like, I'm gonna bring you the check tomorrow. and all the songs that I did that was on Tales from the Crypt was the first beats he heard. And he came back, he was giving me everything. He bring me a check with some money. If he didn't have the money, he said, man, I got a keys to a brand new a Chevelle outside, or a Cutlass. He done brought me a Cutlass, he done brought me a Chevelle, he done brought me a Monte Carlo. For some beats for Marvelous and Sebo. So all of Marvelous,
yeah, shout out to Marvelous
all
and
Sebo
albums too.
Yeah. All of the albums, I'll put music on all of them. I got like maybe five or six on each one of those albums, if not more. I was producing like a good 60% of their records.
Right, you was producing for Killer Tatum when they first came out too and shit. Back when Tatum Looney Corleone was bumping back then, man.
Yes. It got to the point where, you know, it was like he was able to go to the distributor, like, DJ Duro, we got to get DJ Duro on this record. And that's the distributor was more, he was satisfied. He started sending people my way, you know. That's how I ended up doing stuff for Juice and Messy Marv.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, around that time, you had it was a lot of politics in Northern California. You had Frisco guys didn't really do stuff with the Oakland guys. Everybody was cool with JT, the bigger figure, but everybody else was kind of, I don't know if I was rocking with them cats. I kind of broke the barrier with that. I went to Frisco and did some stuff for Juice. I produced his first record. And when I did that, it gave everybody a little comfort zone to be like, okay, I'm about to go to Oakland and get some music from the Oakland cats. Because I had, you know, Sebo way from Sacramento, and I was from Oakland. So to make that connection, it was like, wow, sound was really expanded.
Murder that he read.
But it was
phenomenal.
Yeah,
phenomenal track.
Man, it's crazy because Sebo.
Right?
What's that?
I said, what a way to start off an album. You pop
yeah,
that.
You know,
straight mob.
You know, the Sebo's first album, Autopsy, was nice too. You know, it was nice, but what I do, I get into the artist, you know, and I knew Sebo was a Crip, And so his music had to kind of speak for his lifestyle and what he was talking about. So I try to make sure the sound that I was giving him fit where his background from where he was coming from in the street. So it was more the music was more spooky and mysterious at the same time. You know, and that's the kind of sound I was trying to give him. So when he came with Murder That You Writ and 187 Dance and songs like that, I was thinking about Crips hanging out in the hood, Crip walking and doing their little thing. So that's the mindset I put myself in when I was putting this music together.
Yeah.
So all the albums after that was just, and then his growth, you know, because like one of his big records that he did when he got to Virgin Records was Money by the Ton, and
yeah.
that was the only one record I did for him on that album. That's the first time I only produced one record.
He had a
record
video
for
that, and he was in jail at the time, so he wasn't even in the video, if I'm not mistaken. But that was that was a very controversial album in itself.
Yeah, that album was very controversial. And it's crazy because there's another song. I don't know if you guys are familiar with Richie Rich's Do G's Get to Go to Heaven record?
Yeah. I remember that song.
I wrote that song for Sebo. One of his partners got murdered in the hood. So, you know, he was feeling some kind of way. I remember him, you know, coming to the studio talking about, man, my boy got murdered, man. He wasn't really in a good mood to rap. So, you know, he went to SAG, and I said, when he come back, I'm going to have this song ready for him. And I had the hook already ready to go on the beat. But then he went to jail. So I let Rich hear it. Rich was like, man, this is perfect. I need this. And at this time, we getting, you know, Rich getting ready to sign with Def Jam. Now, what happened was Rich took the hook from off the beat and had Mike Mosley do another beat for it.
Mm.
So
okay.
the beat that I did was just left. So I took the beat and I gave it to Sebo when he came home. So I explained to Sebo, I said, this song was supposed to be for you for the G's Get to Go to Heaven. But Rich used the hook, but the beat is still available. So he made the song I'm a Fool. I'm a Fool, kicking up more dust like the Zulu. He ended up doing that song to the beat that was originally supposed to be G's Get to Go to Heaven song. So it worked out. But a lot of people don't know that. It's like, that's what that beat was for.
Mm.
Hell yeah. And hey, we're going to bring on Pittsburgh Pat. He's got a question for you, Daryl. Pat,
okay.
You there, brother?
Yeah, I'm here, man. Yeah, Daryl, I just asked you about Soldier Slim. I wanted to ask you about these two guys, too, man, because they can't really tell their stories freely. But if you weren't around when these incidents took place that ultimately led to them going to prison, can you at least give us like a memorable story from Mac and C Murder?
Oh man. Mac probably was the hardest one on No Limit. As
mm-hmm.
far as rap goes. Mac was
love
great,
rap
man.
One,
man.
Yeah.
Mac
that's
was
what
one
I
of
think
the
too.
Mac and Fiend was one of the first people that I was introduced to when I first came to the No Limit office. Mac and Fiend. And Mac would just spit something to me like right off the top, you know. He'd just be like, and I'm like, man, this dude right here, right? You know, because you know, Master P, he would let me know, you know, I'm not the greatest. I know I'm not the greatest rapper, but I know how to market. I know how to sell records. But Mac was tight. Now, C Murder, it's funny you say that because when Snoop got over to No Limit, I started, C Murder and Snoop is who I was hanging out with the most. And C Murder was, man, he just was a solid dude, man. Solid. I mean, real solid. He was one of the only dudes I ever see stand up to Master P. You know, Master P was the man. He ran everything, but you know, C Murder was like, I don't care. You know, it was like if we go box, we can box it out. You know, that's how C Murder was. He didn't. He never backed down from Master P. But that's who I was really, out of everybody at No Limit, that's who I was closest to, C-Murder.
C-Murder's a great guy, man. He
really is.
He's a real humble individual. You know, did you see any, you're talking about the boxing out, I mean, notorious stories that they would put on the gloves if they had issues. Did you see any good boxing matches while you were at No Limit?
Well, it never got to that level, because like I said, the only friction I ever seen, okay, C. Murder was dating Mercedes at one time. And I see a situation where Master P had to flash on Mercedes because she was mad at C. Murder for whatever reason. She let some dude drive a car that was given to her by the label. And Master P had to let her know that wasn't cool or whatnot. And then it was a friction between Master P and C. Murder. I don't remember what it was about, but I just remember that everybody was just kind of quiet and off to their own, and C. Murder walking around pacing like, whatever, I don't care, whatever you want to do, we can do it. And Master P wasn't pressing the issue. You know, it never got to a physical confrontation, but you could tell that C. Murder was prepared for it if it was going to happen. He was prepared for it. He was the only one I ever seen actually stand his ground and be ready to deal with Master P on whatever level.
Good old-fashioned brother fight, this fight. Right?
Yeah.
It was about to knuckle up, throw down, huh?
Yeah, but P, I don't think P kind of laughed a lot of this stuff off when it started getting serious. But, you know, the thing that they was really into at No Limit was basketball. Them dudes could play some ball. You know, I come from a little basketball background myself, but I couldn't play with these cats. These cats was playing some real, like, pro ball.
Right. If he was in the pros and shit for a hot little second trying to get in on that shit.
Yeah, but this is before I even knew that he could play that level. You know, we went to the gym one time, and, I mean, all these dudes can play. Everybody at No Limit can play some basketball. And I'm like, man, I'm going to have to sit down. I can't run with you, Cat. Your cat is on a whole other page. You know? Yeah, they can play some
like,
ball.
Like, man, I watch them over here, man.
Yeah, man, they can play some ball. But, yeah, man, it was some good times over at No Limit.
Well, I tell you what, Daryl, man, you've been a hell of a guest. Before you go, though, I got one more caller that I want to give you the floor. You know what I'm saying? Thank you so much for coming on here and spending so much time with us, man. We'd love to have you again in the future, too, because you're definitely one of our most memorable guests. I really appreciate you, brother.
I got a few projects I got coming out, man. I got the DJ Daryl Signature Sound, and I got the documentary Mob Music, and then I'm working on a movie. Yeah, that's the
documentary on the mob sound. You know what I'm saying? The studio tones. Did you guys influence each other, or who created it? I mean, you're known as the creator, but did he have any input in it as well?
Well, I'll give you a little insight on that. Okay, Studio Tone. He did a lot of music with E-40, right?
Yeah.
Okay. 415 came out way before E-40 came out. So I didn't hear Studio Tone until E-40 came out. But before E-40 came out, 415 was really what was changing the music. You got to understand, Oakland is like the threshold. It was like the trend-setting city.
Right.
So all the cities around Oakland was kind of like watching and paying attention to what Oakland was doing. And at the time when we first came out, the only rapper that was out was Too Short and MC Hammer. Those were the only rappers. Mm-hmm. You had Too Short, MC Hammer, Tony, and In Vogue, and Digital Underground.
Pooh Man wasn't around at the time, or did he come after that?
Pooh Man came later. He came later on down the line. See, that's why I have to do the documentary to show how my sound kind of changed and gave the Bay Area what they call a mob sound, because Too Short was, his sound was more of a funk, and his story was pimp.
Right.
He was telling the pimp story. Digital Underground was
and MC Hammer had the funk
like
pop
that.
Too.
MC
well,
Hammer was dancing and doing, you know, him, MC Hammer and Shock G together, they was kind of doing a, what you call the, what they call theater now, with it, you know, the hyping music. They was doing that, you know, they was having fun music. No other rappers in Oakland was doing what Richie Rich was doing. Richie Rich was giving, he was giving you he was giving you what the streets was doing. He was talking about what the streets was doing. And my music, what I was giving him was a soundtrack to what he was talking about. You know, Rich would name actual cats that were on the block selling whatever, you know, if they were selling weed, if they did a Willie that weekend at the Sideshow. I mean, people didn't even know what the Sideshow was. If you wasn't from Oakland, you didn't even know what the Sideshow was until you heard the song Sideshow. So what I was doing was giving what Rich was talking about and what D-Loc was talking about in the records, I was giving them the sound that matched what they were talking about, and they just so happened to be talking about mob stuff, you know, cats who had money, what they were doing, which was the Sideshow, 415. So that whole sound was.
And he had that smooth sound on his voice, too. That shit was nice.
Right. So it that's where it came from. And then later on you start hearing about E-40. But I got to tell you this. It was a time where we would be sitting in the office in our own, you know, 415 had a little office studio, and you can hear the messages. E-40 was one of those guys. E-40 would be like, "Yeah, man, this is Earl Stevens, E-40, man. I sent y'all my demo. I just want to see what y'all think about my music. I'm trying to get signed with the 415 and Big Lee Records." So it was a time when he was trying to hook up with us. So that's why I take credit for saying that I'm the creator of that sound, because nobody was doing it before me.
Prior to you. Yeah.
Right. Then, you know, then when 40 finally got his own platform, and of course, my Studio Tone and all them cats, they was giving him that mob sound as well. But, you know, Vallejo mob sound and Oakland mob sound has always been a little different, because Ann Banks, when he hooked up with Too Short, he started giving Too Short not a mob sound, but a Oakland funk sound. More Too Short already had that funk sound, but Ann Banks just enhanced it. And then, along with Ann Banks, then you got DJ Pooh. MC Pooh. He gave MC Pooh a mob sound, because Pooh was doing the same thing that Rich was doing, but it was Rich that sparked it, talking about the cast that was in the streets, and Banks was giving him a soundtrack. So that's kind of how it came about.
That's legendary. When is this documentary dropping, Daryl? Because we definitely got to check this out.
Well, it's going to be maybe in March. You know, me and my wife, we wanted to get it together sooner, because we had TV One. Want to pick it up, and then we had people saying we should probably make it exclusive to iTunes.
Oh wow!
And it's going to be heavy, you know, because I definitely want to bring on a lot of producers who also take credit for doing my music. You know, I want to get Rick Rock on there, because you know Rick Rock, when I first met Rick Rock, he was a part of Mike Mosey's production team, and he to me always had a sound. It wasn't so-called mob, but he had a sound that was taking a transition, which turned out to becoming that hyphy sound. And I want to, because every studio I was at, Rick Rock was there. And me and Mike Mosey, we're good friends, you know. We're real tight. I met him through working with Marvelous and SIBO. So, and he had a mob sound, too, that he was giving him. So I want to make sure I get them all on board talking about the whole sound and how it's overlooked, because everybody got their own sound. You know, Atlanta has trap music, and, you know, New York got their style of music. L.A. even has its own style of music. And Oakland and the Bay Area always had their own style of music, but nobody never, I mean, they never, it's never been recognized and never been a name put on it, you know, other than the hypey sound. Right now, the hypey sound is known for coming out of the Bay Area, but before that, you had Too Short with the pimp, funk, whatever, but the mob sound has always been overlooked. So it's just one of those things I want to put out there, you know, and the documentary is going to do it.
Oh yeah, I'm glad you're doing that because it's good to document this stuff, you know, and that's what we try to do here with this archive. We try to document what people did because a lot of you guys, you know what I'm saying, even though you might be one of the most successful producers in hip hop, you know what I'm saying, a lot of you guys' stories get swept under the rug, it seems. You know, and
right.
I'm glad to see you doing that, man, and taking a step to you know, show people what you did. And that's what the
movie is going to follow up behind the documentary, because what people don't understand in my story, my movie is about me and everything I had to endure throughout my music career. You know, one of the things, you know, my mom suffers from a mental condition. She has schizophrenia, and when I started doing music when I was like 17. So when I got these cats that's pretty much running Oakland, you know, these drug dealers, they run in Oakland. They come into my mom's apartment to watch me do a routine on some turntables, and at the same time, my mom is in the room going through one of her schizophrenia fits. You know, I got to give her medicine, so I'm juggling this, you know, trying to keep a straight face with the cats that's coming over and making sure my mom is in a peaceful state. All this is in my story about my movie. You know, not to mention that I'm a teenage father trying to take care of a son in my teenage years. You know, so the documentary. It opens the door for the movie. And you know, I'm teeter tottering between the name of the movie right now. It's either going to be called Keep Your Head Up, or it's going to be called Dark Fame. Because the reason why I want to Keep Your Head Up, because Keep Your Head Up is the song that pretty much took me out of the streets of Oakland. You know, because even though I had songs with the 415 and a great success with that, I still was in the streets, and I still was dealing with mob stuff. You know, my executive producer was murdered. You know, it was like a little mob war going on, and he was murdered. And that's how I ended up becoming Richie Rich's DJ. You know, it's a lot to it. You know, it's a lot that you'll learn from the documentary that leads up to the movie. When I put the story out there, it answer a lot of questions. You know, especially with Tupac. You know, because like I said, Tupac, our music influenced him a lot. You know, because we had a song called Court in the Streets, and it was talking about, you know, the police of Oakland, how they dirty they are, you know. And Tupac was Digital Underground, you know, they making fun songs. You know what I'm saying? They having fun with their songs. So when he heard our music, he was like, this is the kind of music I want to do. This is what I need right here. I need to hook up with y'all. And we put him on a record that was one of my boys from the hood, the Gov. The Gov, he was a real D-boy who wanted to rap, you know. And Tupac heard him, and the Gov, you know, he had been shot before. He had been shot in the head. He could only hear out of one ear. But he was determined to become a rapper. And Tupac recognized that. He recognized how me and Rich was helping him, and he wanted to be a part of that. So that kind of stuff motivated Tupac, and that story needs to be told. You know, the Gov ended up being, you know, a pretty big success in Oakland throughout his music. He's in prison now, you know, facing a life term. Because he's, like I said, he's a real street cat, but he was with me when I went to go do the Keep Your Head Up song. When I went to go do the Troublesome 21, I had the Gov with me. So it's that kind of story I want to put out there and show how all of that helped Tupac, how it influenced Tupac to do some of the kind of music he was doing, that he ended up doing.
That's going to be a hell of a film. I mean,
yeah, it's going to be heavy.
You're chronicling your career, and You know, there's so much, so many aspects to that. Are you going to touch on the No Limit stuff too as well?
Yeah, because, you know, everybody that I dealt with, there's a connection. I would have never met Tupac had we not recorded in the studio that we recorded in. And because I was able to do the song with Tupac that was so big, it led me to doing other songs with people like Master P and Sebo and artists. So I'm going to show how all of it was connected, you know, especially the No Limit, because I tell people this all the time. I made more money with No Limit than I have made with anybody in the music industry.
Wow.
And that right there is a lot. And I was only over there for 2 years. My contract with No Limit was for 2 years. And that was the years that it was most popping, you know, 97 to 98. And when I left, my group stayed. Steady Mob and stayed. The group that I brought over there, they stayed. And they came back to the hood and they started letting people know that they were signed to No Limit. And to this day, people don't even really realize that they was never signed to No Limit. They was signed to my company, and I was signed to No Limit. So it's, you know, all that I got to put out in the documentary and the movie. You know, it tells that whole story how, you know. And then there's another story I need to tell, how I was supposed to, I was asked to do the soundtrack to Above the Rim before Death
wow.
Row was ever in the picture.
So they were going to have you do the whole thing.
Yeah, I went to Warner Brothers and I sat down with what's the dude's name? Benny Medina. I keep forgetting his name. Benny Medina. Sit down with Benny Medina, and only thing I had at the time was a demo on Richie Rich. And he had already knew the success from the Keep Your Head Up song from Tupac. So he was like, I played the demo, and he loved Rich. He was like, man, this dude is hot right here. What's up? I need to get him, and I need to get Tupac on some records. And he pulled out the script. He said, man, I'm doing this film called Above the Rim. I will love you to do the whole soundtrack for this film. And if you can get Tupac and Rich on there, you guys can have it. And I contacted Tupac, and of course Tupac was with it, and of course he wanted Tupac to be in the movie. But when I approached Rich with it, Rich was like, I don't want to do it. I want to just focus on my career. So I got passed over on that. It was hard for me to go back and say Tupac was with it, but Rich wasn't with it. You know, then there's a whole story with Rich, you know. Rich feel a little bitter about the 415 breakup. You know, Rich went to jail. He got caught with some dope and went to jail. And while he was in jail, we had to do the second 415 album without him. And the lead rapper at the time was D-Loke, and he tried to take off with the group, leave Rich in the wind. So I got to tell that story. So it's a lot of little stuff that people probably had answers about, questions about that never got the answer. So those answers will come about in the movie.
Hell yeah. Hell yeah. We definitely look forward to that. Daryl, I got the homie Exit Only. I want to bring him on the line. I'm sure he's got a question for you. Exit, how you doing, brother?
I'm good, family. I'm good. What's going on with you? DJ Daryl, the only thing I really want to say, man, is just it's an honor to actually hear you telling your side and what happened. You're kind of like the most known, unknown producers in the game. Everybody done heard your songs, but very few people, except those who really in the music, might not even know who you are. And
right.
You done created classics beyond classics, and to still be in it and to tell the whole story. I know, just like everybody else, incidents are connected. A lot of people think things simultaneously happen, but incidents connect. And to hear how one led to another, bro, you came from the West Coast to the South. I'm from Jackson, Mississippi. I'm in the South. You know what I'm saying?
All
the
right.
reason No Limit actually did a lot of numbers like they did was because Mississippi jumped on Master P quick.
Yeah. Yes, they did. You're right. You're right about that. I appreciate you, man. I do.
Man, I could say it's just an honor, man. I just salute you and keep doing what you're doing, man. For real, you actually done changed the history of music, and people need to know it.
I appreciate it, man, because you know it's so many people, like you said, they didn't hear my music, but there's no face. You know, I come up in that era of making music where, you know, we didn't have social media platforms, we didn't have. You know, you only knew about the producer or the DJ unless the artist mentioned you in a song. You know, like you had
right.
Jazzy Jeff and Jam Master Jay. You know, I come up in that era. You know, and so I'm like, I got one foot in that era and one foot in this new era where everybody got their tags. You know, Mustard on the beat and all that. You know, so I had to make that transition, man, and it was some work. It was a job, man. And that's pretty much what's going on right now. You know, my wife, she was saying the same thing. She like, when I first got with her, she was like, I've heard of a DJ Duro, but I've never knew who he was, you know. And then some of the songs, she was like, oh, I know that song. You did that, you know. So I get a lot of that, Bear, a lot of that. It's a weird feeling to know how much music you've done, but people don't know you. You know, they don't know my face. I walk the streets and I be at Starbucks every day. Starbucks is like my hangout. That's why I go there and put my headphones on. And I mix and master music right on my computer, and people don't even know that. They don't know what I'm doing. They don't know the records I've done and none of that. And then when some people find out, they be really shocked. So it's a weird feeling. It is, man. So it's always appreciated when people like yourself acknowledge. You know, the work I've done, I appreciate you. I appreciate being on the show and everything, man. It's just
and we got to have you on again in the future, man. We definitely
no doubt.
Would love to bring you on again.
Yes, indeed.
We do roundtables, too, you know what I'm saying? Like, we'll get, like, I mean, we had, like, Servine with, you know, DJ Paul, Bushwick Bill, and Gangster Nip, you know what I'm saying, all chopping it up. And maybe you can come on one of those.
Yeah.
We do that like every 100 episodes or so, you know what I'm saying, like an anniversary type show. Maybe you can call it in and chop it up with some mother life, you know what I'm saying? That would be dope as hell.
Well, I got the line now. I can call in, man, and get my input on a few things, too. I appreciate you, man, for having me on here. I really do.
Man.
Oh, yeah, and we
really
appreciate
fun.
You coming on, too, man.
You as well, and you know, if cats want to get at you for beats or something, what's the best way they can reach you, Dale?
Man, the social media. I'm on Twitter. I'm on Facebook and Instagram. It's all under DJ Duro 415, except for Instagram. Instagram is just DJ Duro.
Oh, yeah. Definitely.
And,
thanks a lot for calling in, man. We really, really appreciate you, brother. Had a great time. You know what I'm saying? We look forward to it again. And shout out to Edna. You know,
right.
She's good people. She's good people.
Yeah, she's good people. She lined it up. All right, man. I appreciate y'all.
And we appreciate you, brother. So that was Jay Darrell, you know what I'm saying, a legendary diamond selling producer. You know what I'm saying? Here's
mm-hmm.
a fact, man. This one's Master P and C Murder, More to Life. Check this out.
Ghetto got me crazy, but it's more than life. The bitches weed no Mercedes. This ghetto got me crazy, but it's more than life. The bitches weed no Mercedes. This ghetto got me crazy, but it's more than life. The bitches weed no Mercedes. This ghetto got me crazy, but it's more than life. The bitches weed no Mercedes. Jealous niggas wanna see me dead. Hoes wanna steal my bread. Only time I tell the truest shit I ever said. Now I'm walking with the devil, with the devil. And they done banned my movies because a nigga from the ghetto. No nominees from the Grammys. But ask every nigga that brought ghetto D, do we sell whammies? Tears in my eyes from this street pain. The last time I see my little brother was in the sheet bang. In the fast follow me like I'm slanging crack. Wasting tax dollars cause I'm young, rich, famous, and black. This ghetto got me crazy, but it's more than life. The bitches weed, I'm a Mercedes. This ghetto got
other. Crack babies in the hood with AIDS-infected mothers. Hypocrite preachers teaching the word and gave us shelters and rehab when dope hit the suburbs. Why Bill Gates buying islands? See, we from the ghetto where ain't nobody smiling. Where the poor live hungry. And penitentiaries packed and sell t-shirts from my dead home.
This ghetto got me crazy,
crazy.
But it's more to life than bitches, weed, and a Mercedes. This ghetto got me crazy,
crazy.
But it's more to life than bitches, weed, and a Mercedes.
I'm still mad at the world cause I ain't got nothing to lose. A lot of young cats out there, I know wanna stand in my shoes. Man, I'm just a young thug nigga. Got lucky with some paper. Motherfuckers call me see murder cause they know I ain't no faker. Dug and died in the penitentiary and running from debt. I ain't got nothing but no limits. So I'm representing with my last breath. My tattoos represent my thoughts like a work of art. My mama cried when she saw me feel my pain. Cat across my heart. My enemies driving like flies. Know what the bitches wanna know why. Just take the D off my name and you left with a homicide. You see the ghetto made me crazy. But it also made me real. I thank God for my hard times. The ghetto ties made me hard to kill.
This ghetto got me crazy. But it's more than life than bitches, weed, and Mercedes. This ghetto got me crazy. But it's more than life than bitches, weed, and Mercedes. This ghetto got me crazy. But it's more than life than bitches, weed, and Mercedes. This ghetto got us crazy. But it's more than life than bitches, weed, and Mercedes.
This ghetto got us crazy. But you know what? It's more than life.